Well, good morning, church. You can have a seat, and as you do so, good morning. My name is Ben Clausen, not Benjamin Pinkerton, as you might know, and I'm really honored to get to be here with you guys this morning. Ben Pinkerton, your college pastor, was supposed to be here this morning, but the Pinkerton family has been stricken ill, so you can pray for them, and they definitely could use your prayers this weekend. But in the gap, I'm super, super glad to get to be here with you guys. I went to Anderson College for my entire time in college, and then I worked as a fellow in the college ministry for a couple of years. So this sort of feels like homecoming for me. This is the room that I sat in and learned a ton about the scriptures, and I'm just really overjoyed. It's one of those cool moments that, wow, God let me be up here now. So really glad to get to be here with you guys today. I might have already said I'm the college minister over at our Creekside campus, but it's fun to get to be over here now. That's an important thing, but much more important is I am the husband of Hannah and the father of Ivy. She's 9 months old now, but I like to still say that I'm a new dad. That feels like it offers me more grace. But a lot of dads are known for like showing pictures of their kids without people asking them to. I've never really understood that. I've never really been somebody that just like offers up pictures of my kids without somebody asking. I really don't get, oh, there she was on Christmas reading her book. Oh my goodness, she's just the best. Anyway, I don't get why people do that without anyone asking. If you want to see a picture of my kid, you'll ask, right? So anyway, that's Ivy. And like I said, super glad to be here with you guys this morning. We're going to look at one of my favorite passages in the scriptures. But before we do, I want to tell you a story that I actually heard a few years ago that's one of my favorite stories in just about the history of time. And this story is about a man named Cliff Young. Cliff Young is a man who ran a race a few years back. And this race was known as the Australian Ultra Marathon. There might be some marathoners in the room. You don't have to show your hand. I'm sure you would be proud to. But there's a unintentional dig. But there's a race every single year in Australia known as the Ultra Marathon, and it is 543.7 miles. 543.7 miles. Can you imagine? Somehow people do this. And your typical runner is like 30 years old, ultra fit, peak of their life. They can run for days on end. It's insane. But actually, in the year 1984, a man named Cliff Young decided to run this ultra marathon in Australia. And this is what Cliff looked like. He was 61 years old. He showed up to sign up for this race, and they were like, "Sir, I think you're in the wrong place." To which he said, "No, I'm ready to run this ultra marathon. I like 543.7 miles. That sounds pretty doable." And they were like, "You know what this is, right?" And he explained to them, "Well, my family didn't have a lot of money growing up, and we lived on a ton of land, and I had all these sheep. And instead of having sheepdogs who would herd and shepherd the sheep." I would do it. So that was his explanation that was his training for a 543.7 mile marathon. So they let him do it, and they show up to run this race. All the runners line up, of course, and, they take off. They start running, and really quickly, Cliff gets far behind all the rest of the runners, because Cliff is doing this thing that, spoiler alert, becomes known in the future as the Cliff Young Shuffle, and I will demonstrate. Sorry, cameras. It's sort of this little Cliff Young Shuffle. It's like this. He doesn't move his arms. It's very low effort, and it's a little bit ridiculous looking. So really quickly, he gets very, very far behind all of the competition. He's like struggling to catch up. And the way that these races work is essentially the runners run for 18 hours, and then they sleep for six. They run for 18 hours, and then they sleep for six. Run for 18, sleep for six. Can you even imagine? And they do this for days on end until finally they finish the race. But the only problem was Cliff didn't actually know the way that these races were run. So instead of sleeping after 18 hours, Cliff kept on going through the night, and then through the day, and then through the next night. And believe it or not, 61-year-old potato farmer Cliff Young won the race and set the fastest record for the quickest ultramarathon of all time by 19 hours. By 19 hours. And he is now the most hated man in the ultramarathon world, because that's how the race works now. Can you imagine? And I love the story of Cliff's interview afterward. They're like, Cliff, how did you do it? How did you do it? And Cliff just said, well, I just didn't stop. I just didn't stop. That's his advice for running an ultra marathon. And the reason that I tell you that story is because the scriptures do this thing where they liken our lives to a race. The scriptures say that in front of every single one of us is a lifelong race. And this race is a race that at times, if we're honest, can be a little bit brutal. And in fact, it's a race that sort of all kinds of things come from our left and from our right and try and encourage us to quit. To quit, to give up, to grow, as our passage says today, weary and faint-hearted. And instead of pressing on and running the race set before us with endurance, to actually give up, to give in, to stop reading our Bibles, to stop choosing righteousness over sin, to stop praying, to stop pursuing God, there are all sorts of things in front of us that are trying to get us to pull us off our race, all sorts of things the enemy's throwing at us to get us to quit running. So you and me have need of something that Cliff Young had in abundance, and that resource is known as endurance. Endurance. In the scriptures, there's this word called hupomone, and hupomone is the biblical word for endurance, and it's actually a word picture in a way, and the picture that it provides is of somebody coming up under some huge weight and just staying there, remaining under some huge weight, and that's the picture of endurance, and that's what the scriptures say we need, because what's going to come at all of us is a huge weight and temptation to get out from under it and just quit, quit here, quit there. So today what we're going to see is that the scriptures encourage us. We have need of endurance, of endurance. And the good news is there's an entire book of the Bible written to a number of Christians who are tempted to give up, and that's the book of Hebrews. If you don't know the context of the book of Hebrews, in this book it's written to some Jewish Christians who have recently converted to from Judaism to Christianity. And if you don't know first century Jewish Christian history, that's actually not a like socially wise thing to do. If you converted from Judaism to Christianity, you went from the powerful to the powerless. You went from comfort to persecution. You signed up for your life to be not easy. Why would you do it? Because it's true. Because it's real. Because there's no teacher like Jesus of Nazareth. And yet, these Jewish Christians were facing all sorts of temptations to give up, to grow weary and faint-hearted and give up. And that's why the writer of Hebrews in chapter 10 says this to them. He says, but recall the former days after you were enlightened, how you endured a hard struggle with suffering, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those treated. And then verse 35, therefore do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. What the writer of Hebrews says is that if you're going to chase after God, you and me have need of endurance. If we want to get to the end of our lives and be able to say with the Apostle Paul, I have run, the time of my departure has come. I've fought the good fight. I've finished the race. I've kept the faith. If we want to get to the end of our lives and be able to say, I've run my race well, then you and me need endurance. So the good news is, Hebrews chapter 12, one of my favorite passages in the scripture, is going to give us three places that we need to look, that we need to look if we desire to run the race set before us with endurance. Three places we need to look if we want to run the race set before us with endurance. So if you've got a copy of the scriptures, yeah, we'll be in in Hebrews chapter 12 today. And Hebrews, if you recall, we don't know who wrote it, but again, we know that it was written by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit to believers in this age who were tempted to give up, and then also for you and me today, for you and me today, to show us how we can endure as we run along the race that's set before us. So I'm going to read chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, and then we're going to jump back into verse 1 and see the first thing that we need to do if we're going to run the race set before us with endurance. So let's do it. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. So for you and me, the first thing that we need to do if we want to run the race set before us with endurance is look around. Look again at verse 1, what it says. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, what's it referring to there? So it opens with the word therefore. Church, what do we do when we see a therefore? We ask the question, what's it therefore? That's right, well done. So what's it therefore? It's there to connect us to the previous chapter. And the previous chapter is chapter 11 of Hebrews, which is known as the great faith chapter, the hall of faith. It focuses on all of these amazing figures from church history, from biblical history, who did these amazing things by faith. It talks about Abel, who by faith offered up a God-honoring sacrifice. It says, remember Enoch, who by faith lived righteously and therefore didn't die. Remember Noah, who by faith survived a population-destroying flood. Remember Abraham, who by faith radically obeyed God. Remember Sarah, who by faith bore a son from whom nations would descend. Remember Moses, who by faith stood up to the most powerful man in the world and let God set his people free. Remember Rahab, who by faith saved people, God's people, from destruction. And then I love what it says in verses 33 and 34 of chapter 11. And what more shall I say? For time would fail me to speak of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, and David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, enforced justice, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the power of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, were made strong out of weakness, became mighty in war, and put foreign armies to flight. Remember these people. Since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, what does he go on to say? Let us also. That little command right there is beautiful. Think about what he's saying right there. Remember all of God's amazing faithful followers throughout all of history, all the amazing things that God used them to do throughout history? Let us also. It's an invitation for you and me to be written into the story of all of God's faithful. It's an invitation to be written into the story of faithfulness. And it's an encouragement to look around you at the cloud of witnesses that existed throughout biblical history and exist around you today. It's an invitation to be inspired by the faith of other people around you, right? I don't know if you've ever been inspired by the faith of people around you before, but I've had several moments in my life that I've gotten close to someone and I've gotten to observe them and say, wow, I just am amazed by the faith in God that I see in this person. I remember when I met a guy named Brett for the first time. Brett actually goes here now. I probably should have told him I was going to talk about him. But Brett, I met for the first time when I led a team of college students on a mission trip to North Africa. Brett was one of our Grace goers in this country in North Africa that was less than 2% Christian. In the place where he lived, there was little to no gospel work ever throughout all of history happening. And I remember as I met Brett, I realized what he had been asked to do was move to this city where there were basically no other believers and figure everything out. Figure out the language, the way that like public transportation works, the way that the city is laid out. That's hard enough to do in a foreign country, right? But in a country where you don't speak any of the language, very, very difficult. And it's not like a tourist city where they're trying to make it easy for you. So he moved there, and at the same time that he had moved over there, what was he doing? He was sharing the gospel in coffee shops, and people were coming to know Christ. It was crazy. And then all of a sudden, these local believers who spoke the language, he was training them to share the gospel, and then they were going out and leading their friends to Christ, and people left and right were starting to trust in Jesus, and it was the most beautiful thing. And I remember being like, wow, God, like God's using you to do that. That's amazing. And because I witnessed the faith of Brett, the things that he was doing in a foreign country, my own faith was stirred to see and believe in what God is possible or what God's capable of doing. So I wonder if you've got faith-stirring people around you. If you've got faith-stirring people around you, I think what the author is saying here is that every single one of us, we need people who we spend time around and our faith just lights up, that our cup overflows. So I don't know if you're in a community here at Anderson. I know a lot of you, so I know that there are some really, really amazing faith-stirring people here at this church. So I just want to encourage you, if you don't have anyone in your life who you would consider someone who stirs your own faith, I'd love to encourage you to get plugged into an Anderson group here. This is an amazing place with lots of people who would love to help stir your faith. And then one of my favorite things to do to look around me at the cloud of witnesses is to find an older and wiser saint. find somebody who's a few life stages ahead of me who I can look at and say, so that's what it looks like to be a faithful disciple-making dad for decades. So that's what it looks like to be a great gospel preacher for decades. Find older and wiser saints around you to ask the question, how do I keep going? How do I run the race that's set before me with endurance? The first thing that the author of Hebrews tells us we need to do is look around us. And then look how it goes on. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that's set before us. So what he says, the second thing that we need to do is we need to look in. We need to look in. And specifically, we need to look in at the weights and sins that keep us from chasing after Christ. So there's a little bit of a distinction here between weights and sins, right? Weights and sins. So it can be a little bit tricky. He's not just using sort of the same term here. He's using two very different terms. First, he uses sins. Sins are kind of easy to diagnose, right? Sins are the things that God does not want. Every single one of us has sin, which is why Jesus had to die on the cross to pay the payment that our sin deserved. All of us have sin in our life, lust and pride and materialism and all these different things. So that's sins. But then weights, on the other hand, are a little bit different. Weights are things that aren't in the moral or immoral category, but are sort of in the middle. They're amoral. They don't have any innate morality attached to them. You can think of weights, like my friend Justin, who ate lemon pound cake on the way to a basketball tournament in junior high. I remember this. It was a legendary story that went around. All my friends were on a bus on the way to a basketball tournament, you know, fueling on power butter and bananas and stuff. But what does Justin do but eat half of a lemon pound cake right before a basketball tournament? You know that that's not a good idea. Somehow he didn't know that that was wasn't a good idea. So what happens when Justin gets out, starts running up and down the court? You can only guess. He spent some time with the trash can, and it wasn't good at all. And I tell you that because was it sinful for him to eat lemon pound cake before a basketball tournament? Well, no, it wasn't innately sinful. It was sort of an amoral, there's no morality to it, but it didn't help him run. It was unwise. And weights are like this. Excuse me. They're not sinful, but they are slowing. They're not sinful, but they're slowing. They slow down your run. They slow down your pursuit of Jesus. And they're a little bit hard to diagnose, right? So I work with college students, so I think all the time about how for my generation and the generation behind me, one of the greatest weights that keeps us from chasing after Jesus is screens, right? Like, it used to be that you would get bored or be standing in line or just sitting somewhere, and you would just think, oh, whoa, or even pray, maybe. But now, what do you do if you're just standing somewhere waiting? Screen, screen, screen. And there's this thing called phantom screen. I don't remember what it's called. Something like phantom screens, where when you don't have your phone in your pocket, you sort of start to freak out, right? You're like, where's my phone? You ever had that experience before? It's a real thing. And let me just ask, or challenge you, I really think that that's a weight that encumbers us. What are our lives meant to be about? King Jesus practicing his presence, praying without ceasing, and yet every single one of us is distracted often by a screen that's always with us, just about 24/7. Or you can think about, I see a lot of people that are encumbered by the weight of overcommitment, the weight of overcommitment. What do? I go straight from this to this to this to this practice with my kids to this extracurricular to this thing to this thing to this thing. And what have you done through overcommitment? It's choked out space for time with Jesus. It's choked out space to do family discipleship. It's choked out space for deep, meaningful abiding in Jesus. So I don't know what the weight is that you feel like encumbers your soul. But every single one of us have both weights and sins that cling to us so closely that we desperately need to lay down. And what he's encouraging us to do here is to look into our hearts and say, what are those things that are keeping me from running full force after Jesus? Why is this so important? A few years ago, in college, I lived with a guy named Drake. And Drake was in Teeks Fire School. I don't know if you know this, but we actually have one of the best firefighter training schools in the country here in Bryan, Texas. How about that? Pretty amazing. And when Drake was training to be a firefighter, there was this challenge that was put before him and all the other firefighters, and it was that they all had to run a 7-minute mile. Ah, it's pretty quick. And Drake was Drake was awesome. He was a very fit guy, but he was like this kind of fit, not like this kind of fit. So a 7-minute mile was like pretty big challenge. And I remember Drake trained relentlessly. He was my roommate. So he was up at like 5 a.m. every morning running, trying to train for this 7-minute mile. And then finally, he gets to this day and he does it. They all the firefighters run the 7-minute mile. They're high-fiving and it's amazing. And then their coach or teacher, professor, whatever, walks up and he's sort of doing like a sarcastic clap. And they're like, what's this about? And he's like, okay, well done. Here's some fireproof pants, fireproof jacket, oxygen tank, helmet, and a hose. Now do it again. And Drake told me that the question that they were all asking when they said this is, how are we supposed to run with all this weight? How are we supposed to run with all this weight? The same's true for your pursuit of Jesus. You think that there are these things that aren't really slowing down your pursuit of Jesus, but in reality, you're running with weights tied around your ankles. And I think the encouragement from the writer of Hebrews here is, if you really want to be known as somebody who chases after Jesus headlong all the days of your life, the most important thing is you need to look in and consider, what are the weights and sins that I need to let go of, that I need to lay down? I need to lay down. How do we do it? Prayer and counsel. Prayer and counsel. I love what the psalmist David says in Psalm 139, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." It's an invitation. This is a really hard invitation if you've ever thought about this. It's an inviting of God to perceive the evil that dwells within your heart. That's what David's asking. That's what we need to say. We need to say, God, would you just show me by your grace if there's any place that evil or sin has a stronghold or weights have a stronghold in my heart? We need to pray. And then second, we need counsel. We need wise counsel. The late pastor Tim Keller had this phrase that he used that I love. He said, we need to give to people a hunting license for our sin. I don't know if you've heard this expression before, but it's essentially saying to a few trusted people around you, hey, I want to give you complete permission to hunt down any fiber of sin that you see in my life. Chase down, pursue, take aim, and fire at any sin that you see in my life. It's one of the most amazing things for me has been to give a hunting license for my sin to a couple of guys. Michael and Andrew, who actually both go here, are my accountability, who have a complete hunting license for my sin. And sometimes they hit their limit, if you know what I mean. It's not great. But the reality is, because I'm walking with these guys and pursuing after the Lord with them, I've been able to perceive weights and sins that I never would have seen on my own. And we all need people like that around us to help look into our hearts and say, look, I think there's a blind spot here. I think you've got a place here that you could lay down a weight and sin. We need to look around us to the faith of other people. We need to look into us to see the weights and sins that encumber us. And then finally, we need to look up to Christ. We need to look up to Christ. Look how he finishes here in Hebrews 12. He says, and run the race with endurance that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. The third thing that we need to do if we want to run the race set before us with endurance is we need to look up to Jesus. We need to look up to Jesus. Notice sort of why he says we need to look up to Jesus. Sort of two reasons. Why? Because he's both the author or the founder and the perfecter or the finisher of our faith. He's the author and perfecter. Author and perfecter. What do we mean by that? Well, first, he's the author or founder. He's the author with the pen who wrote out the story, right? I love the way that John 1 puts it. It says, he was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. Jesus is the agent of creation. And then Colossians 1:16, for by him all things were created in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him. Jesus is the author of our faith, but he's also the perfecter of our faith. This is the beautiful thing about the Christian God that is incomparable, right? Not only is he a deity who's almighty and powerful and made everything and laid it out and has all power over human history, He's also the only God who took on flesh and who, guess what, perfected our faith. No other God can claim that they actually walked the complete life that you and me walk. But a couple passages ago, chapters ago in Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews actually said, "For we do not have a great high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin." Jesus ran the same race that we did, but he ran it perfectly, right? He ran the same race that we ran, but he ran it perfectly. And in reality, it says that he's not only the perfect example now of love and joy and peace and patience. His life is not only the template for those things, but also for endurance. If we want to run with endurance, we need to look at the perfect example of endurance in Jesus. I mean, just look what it says. Look at Jesus, who for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. We can look at Jesus because his life is the model for endurance. Just think about it with me for a minute. When Jesus was tempted by Satan in the wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights, what did he do? He endured. When Jesus started preaching and his own family thought he was crazy, when his disciples didn't understand what he was trying to tell them, when crowds of people doubted his truthfulness, when Pharisees ridiculed him, what did Jesus do? Jesus endured. When people started plotting his death, and when Judas, one of his own close followers, betrayed him for 30 pieces of silver, Jesus endured. When Jesus knew that death was coming his way and he pleaded with his father at Gethsemane to take the cup of death away from him, Jesus endured. When Jesus was arrested, went through the illegal trials, when his own disciples started denying him, Jesus endured. When he was mocked and scorned and beaten beyond recognition, Jesus endured. When he was nailed to the cross and hung there for hours waiting for death, he endured. When Jesus saw that the end was coming and he shouted, "Tetelestai, it is finished," Jesus endured. And when Jesus was in the grave for 3 days, what did he do? He endured until the endurance ceased and breath filled his lungs once more. Jesus rose in victory from the grave, conquering sin, conquering death, conquering the enemy, and ascended to the right hand of the throne of God, where now he sits next to God, enthroned and bowering, offering to you and me salvation by grace alone, through faith alone, and Christ alone, now, tomorrow, and forevermore. Because of the endurance of Jesus, we're saved. We're set free. He's the template of endurance. We can look to Jesus who endured it all, who endured it all. So how does this help you run? Think about it with me for a minute. If you only look around you at the faith of other people, that's only going to get you so far. Because if you only are inspired by other people, but you don't have what they have deep within you, that only gets you so far. And if you look in and lay down weights and sins, but you have not love, you're a moralist, a Pharisee. But if you spend your days and your life gazing upon the beauty of Jesus' face in his temple, if you wake up and you abide in Jesus, if you take your time to look upon Jesus' face, if you turn your eyes upon Jesus, as we sing, oh my gosh, you'll run and not grow weary. You'll be able to say with the Apostle Paul, "I've run my race. I finished this thing. I did it well." So may we be people who not only look around us at the faith of other people and look in us and lay down weights and sins, but also look up to King Jesus. One of my favorite characters in all of fiction comes from the Book of Narnia. Any Narnia fans out there? One of my favorite characters in all fiction is the mouse Reepicheep, right? We love Reepicheep. He's the leader of the talking mice in Narnia. And Reepicheep is the model of valor and strength and zeal and godliness, honestly, a tiny mouse. And in one of the middle books, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, there's this amazing story where the Dawn Treader, which is this really great boat, is sailing east. And at the eastmost point of the world is Aslan's country. And if you've never read Narnia, you know that it's sort of Aslan's country is an allegory for the place that God himself is. They're sailing toward the presence of God, toward eternity. And there are all these people on the boat, but then there starts to come this moment that lots of the other characters sort of get distracted. They start focusing on other things. They sort of start to say, well, I don't know if I want to go to Aslan's country. I actually kind of want to sail back. I want to head back. And there's this moment that they ask Reepicheep, "We're all heading back, but what are you doing?" And he has this remarkable quote where he says, "As for me, my own plans are made. While I can, I sail east in the Dawn Treader. When she fails me, I paddle east in my coracle. When she sinks, I shall swim east with my four paws. And when I can swim no longer, if I have not reached Aslan's country or shot over the edge of the world in some vast cataract, I will sink with my nose to the sunrise. I love that quote because for this tiny little mouse, it doesn't matter what's coming his way. He's fixed on Aslan's country. I'm going home. I'm sailing for a better country. And I love the heart of this passage. You know what it says? When your eyes are fixed upon Jesus, let materialism, the snares of this world come my way. My eyes are on Jesus. Let lust or adultery come my way. My eyes are on Jesus. Let any scheme of the enemy come toward me. My eyes are on Jesus, the author and perfecter of my faith. It doesn't matter what comes my way, beauty or pain or hurt or riches or poverty. It doesn't matter what comes my way. My eyes are on Jesus. My own plans are made. So church, may we be people who have our eyes continually fixed upon Jesus and therefore are able to run the race that's set before us with endurance, with endurance. So as we close today, I just want to give you guys a few minutes to spend a little bit of time with the Lord asking these questions. Just spend a couple of minutes now asking God, what is it from this passage that I need to take away? How can I look around me this specific week, this week ahead of me? Who are the faithful around me whose faith needs to stir my own? Have I been neglecting to gather together with your saints? And then second, ask, how can I look in and lay down weights and sins this week? Are there any blind spots in my life, Lord, that I need to have you step in and help me to lay down either a sin that's clear or a weight that's maybe kind of sneaky and hiding? What's that area? And then finally, how can I look up to Jesus this week? Lord, have I been lacking in zeal of keeping my eyes fixed on your face? Lord, would you help me to do that now? So take just a couple of minutes and ask the Lord these questions, and then we'll close in prayer and worship. Well, Father, we believe that there's no one like you. Jesus, we believe that there's no one like you in whom our hope is found. I just remember that moment that tons of disciples start to leave you, Jesus, and you turn to your disciples and say, are you going to go too? And Peter says, Lord, where else would we go? You have the words of life. Jesus, thanks that you have the words of life, that in your presence is fullness of joy. Thank you that there's nothing like chasing after you. Pray you'd help us to be people, as we sang just a little bit ago, that turn our eyes upon Jesus, who look full in his wonderful face and watches the things of earth grow strangely dim in the light of your glory and grace. It's in your name we pray, Lord Jesus. Amen.